Chapter 7. I Have a Bad Feeling About This. 1976 through 1977. Barely 2 weeks into filming Star Wars, and George Lucas was ready to kill Sir Alec Guinness. It is quite a shock to an actor when you say, "I know you have a big part, and all of a sudden I have decided to kill you," Lucas told a writer for Rolling Stone in 1977. But to Lucas's mind, killing off Guinness's character Obi-Wan Kenobi was vital to the film, correcting what Lucas saw as a major shortcoming in the latest draft of his always evolving script. "There was no real threat in the Death Star," Lucas explained. In his latest draft, Kenobi survived his lightsaber duel with Darth Vader by retreating through a blast door that slammed shut behind him. That not only left Vader with egg on his face, as Lucas put it, but also made the assault on the Death Star little more than a bit of galactic breaking and entering, with Vader as a flummoxed shopkeeper shaking his fist in rage as the heroes escaped unharmed. "This was dumb," said Lucas flatly. "They run into the Death Star and they sort of take over everything and they run back. It totally diminished any impact the Death Star had." It was Marcia who had put Ben Kenobi's head on the block, pointing out to George that after escaping the Death Star, the old general didn't have much to do for the rest of the film. Lucas had to agree. The character stood around with his thumb in his ear, and Marcia suggested that Kenobi be killed in his lightsaber duel and then offer Luke advice as a spirit guide in the final act. Lucas may have cringed at the idea of killing off his film's only Oscar-winning actor, but he knew Marcia was right. Marcia was very opinionated and had very good opinions about things, and would not put up with it if she thought George was going off in the wrong direction, said Walter Murch. There were heated creative arguments between them, for the good. Debating the case with Marcia, however, was nothing compared with breaking the news to Guinness himself. In early April 1976, Lucas was with Guinness in Tunisia, where they'd spent the better part of a week filming the scenes set on the desert planet of Tatooine. Lucas, his nerve finally steeled, pulled the actor aside to break the news about the fate of Ben Kenobi, but then waffled, telling Guinness he hadn't really made a final decision yet. According to Lucas, Guinness kept it under control, but privately the actor was fuming, irritated by Lucas saying he hadn't made up his mind whether to kill off my part or not. A bit late for such decisions. Lucas would make up his mind for good only a few days later. As filming began at Elstree Studios in London, Lucas informed Guinness that Ben Kenobi would die at the hands of Darth Vader. This time, Guinness wouldn't keep it under control. "I'm not doing this," he told Lucas tersely, and threatened to leave the film altogether. Trying to smooth things over and keep his biggest name actor from walking out, Lucas took Guinness to lunch to make his case. "I explained that in the last half of the movie, he didn't have anything to do. It wasn't dramatic to have him standing around, and I wanted his character to have an impact," said Lucas. Guinness considered carefully, listening as Lucas argued that having Kenobi as a spirit guide was really a Castaneda Tales of Power thing. Guinness agreed to stay. "I simply trust the director," he would explain later. But in truth, Guinness would never be entirely comfortable in Obi-Wan's cloak. Still, Lucas was paying him well. Lovely bread, Guinness admitted privately, and had thrown in 2 profit points to boot, which made the rubbish dialogue easier to say and swallow. "I must confess I'm pretty much lost as to what is required of me," Guinness admitted to the Sunday Times a month later. "What I'm supposed to be doing, I can't really say." Publicly, however, Lucas reported that Guinness took it all very well and developed the character accordingly. The crisis had been averted, but it would be far from the last. From day one, Star Wars would be a problem-plagued production that would blow through its budget, mentally and physically exhaust Lucas, and so try the patience of executives at Fox that the studio very nearly pulled the plug on the film altogether. "I forgot how impossible making movies really is," a weary Lucas wrote in a letter to Marcia during filming. "I get so depressed, but I guess I'll get through it somehow." 3 months before filming began, and well before he was even considering killing off Guinness's Obi-Wan, Lucas left California in January 1976 headed for England, where he took over the production offices at sprawling Elstree Studios in northern London. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, John Dykstra and ILM were supposed to be putting together the first of the 360 special effects shots Lucas had asked for. Unfortunately, most of their time was still devoted to building the cameras, optical printers, and other equipment that would be needed to film and assemble the visual effects. "We designed and built our own electronics from scratch," Dykstra said proudly. "But every day spent manufacturing the technology meant another lost day of filming the effects themselves. And with Lucas now in London, where he could no longer drop in unannounced or hover over the work, ILM would only fall farther and farther behind." Lucas took with him the fourth draft of the script, which he had completed on January 1st. Typically, he still wasn't happy with it, though he was pleased with the script's new opening line. "A long, long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, an incredible adventure took place." The rest of the writing, however, he found painful, atrocious, and decided that with filming scheduled to begin in 12 weeks, it was probably time to bring in a writer, or in this case, writers, to give the script a once-over. "I never arrived at a degree of satisfaction where I thought the screenplay was perfect," he said later. "If I hadn't been forced to shoot the film, I would doubtless still be rewriting it now." Lucas called on Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, his reliable collaborators on American Graffiti, and brought them to London to work on a rewrite. The Hikes worked with their typical speed, sanding some of the jargon-heavy edges off Lucas's script, tightening the dialogue in a few key places, and paying particular attention to the banter between characters, especially the interaction between Han and Leia. They would also add an in-joke in which Leia is held captive on the Death Star in cell number 2187, a nod to the Arthur Lipsett film Lucas loved. In lieu of payment, Lucas gave them something that would eventually be much more lucrative, 2 percentage points. Meanwhile, over at Elstree, Lucas had makeup artist Stuart Freeborn, who had created the convincing apes featured in the opening moments of 2001, hard at work creating the makeup and prosthetics for Chewbacca and other aliens. In another workshop was costume designer John Mollo, a historian with a love of military uniforms, who had been put in charge of designing and making armor and costumes, a task he jumped into with such relish that he was producing them almost faster than Lucas could look at them. John Barry sets were also under construction at all hours of the day, sprawled across 8 of Elstree's sound stages, including one set taken up entirely by a full-sized Millennium Falcon. Most sets would still be under construction when filming began at Elstree in April. The pace was exhausting, and Lucas hadn't shot an inch of film yet. Making things even more unbearable, Lucas hated London. "George wasn't happy there. He doesn't like to be away from home," said Kurtz. "Everything is different enough to throw you off balance." It wasn't just driving on the opposite side of the road that made him nervous. He didn't enjoy the food. He found it impossible to get a decent hamburger, and was irritated that the light switches were upside down. Worse, the house he was renting in the Hampstead area of London was broken into, and his television set was stolen. Not that it mattered. He frequently complained that there was nothing decent to watch on TV anyway. With only days to go before cameras rolled, Alan Ladd dropped in on Lucas and Kurtz to review the fine print in the budget. Fox executives had directed Ladd to warn Lucas that once costumes, makeup, armor, sets, and the costs of travel were folded in, the final budget needed to come in under $10 million. "This will only work if everything goes perfectly," Kurtz cautioned Ladd, "and it rarely does." Duly chastened by Ladd and Fox, Lucas insolently pegged his budget at $9,999,999. It didn't matter, it would never be enough, and Ladd left London feeling less and less certain that Lucas had his production costs under control. On the morning of Thursday, March 18th, Lucas and much of the Star Wars crew departed London for Djerba, an island just off the coast of Tunisia in North Africa. From there, a 6-hour drive into the interior of Tunisia brought them to the sun-beached salt flats of Nefta, where John Barry's craftsmen, After slogging through the desert, dragging their materials in the beds of trucks and on the backs of donkeys, had built Luke's homestead, as well as the bottom half of an enormous Jawa sandcrawler. In keeping with Lucas's used universe aesthetic, everything looked as if it had already been there for a century or more. And the sandcrawler, in fact, with its gigantic tank-like treads, had piqued the interest of the government in adjacent Libya, which had rushed inspectors across the border to ensure Lucas's crew wasn't constructing some newfangled military vehicle. Filming on Star Wars began at 6:30 a.m. on Monday, March 22, 1976. It was a catastrophe almost from the start. Things started going wrong, said Kurtz with typical understatement. Wind and heavy rains, the first rainfall in the Tunisian desert in nearly a decade, damaged sets and props, and rapidly fading light made it nearly impossible for Lucas to film Hamill as Luke Skywalker, quietly contemplating his dreams against the blazing desert sunset. It would take 3 days before Lucas could get the now iconic shot on film. Remote control robots malfunctioned, and Anthony Daniels, in his ill-fitting C-3PO costume, could barely see and hear, and couldn't take more than a few steps without falling over. "I was very, very tired and very cross," said Daniels. And then there was Lucas's own self-imposed misery involving the script and his hand-wringing over the decision to kill off Ben Kenobi. Guinness may have been annoyed with Lucas's indecision, but for the most part, Sir Alec eagerly, even enthusiastically, supported Lucas's vision for the film. On his first day of filming, he took great relish in rolling in the dirt to give his own wardrobe the same used universe look as the rest of the film. Lucas admitted he was in awe of the Englishman. "He's huge and I'm so small," said Lucas. "I didn't know where to put myself." By the end of the 2-week Tunisian shoot, Lucas was desperately unhappy. But with work wrapped on location, production would now move to Elstree, and what Lucas expected would be a much more stable and controllable studio environment. "I was hoping things would go better," Lucas said later. But they didn't. Things were very much under control at Elstree, but unfortunately, Lucas wasn't the one controlling them. British unions kept all activity to a heavily regulated and routinized schedule. An 8:30 a.m. start, tea at 10, lunch for an hour starting at 1:15 p.m., with another tea break at 4, and the crew would stop promptly at 5:30 p.m., whether the work was finished or not. The 5:30 quitting time was particularly galling to Lucas, who had never had much patience with unions anyway, and was used to working late into the evening to get just the right shot or finish a particularly long scene. Lucas would corral Kurtz to help him plead with the union representatives for additional time, almost always without success. "The crew got upset with both of us," said Lucas. "I ended up having to be nice to everybody, which is hard when you don't like a lot of people." The British crew members were also baffled by what kind of movie exactly these Americans were making, derisively referring to Chewbacca as the dog, snickering as grown men and women fired weapons that made no noise, and watching in amusement as Lucas fumed over yet another stalled R2 unit. "The British crew thought we were all out of our minds," recalled Harrison Ford. "They just thought that it was ludicrous and stupid." As Lucas put it, "I was just this crazy American who was doing this really dopey movie." Lucas had only himself to blame for some of the friction. His quiet, somewhat terse style grated on the British. "All film crews are a matter of chemistry," said Kurtz diplomatically. "George is not a particularly social person. He doesn't go out of his way to socialize. It takes him a while to know somebody, to get intimate enough to share his problems with them. It's easier for him to work with people he knows." For Lucas, though, people were precisely the problem. "Directing is very difficult because you're making 1,000 decisions. There are no hard and fast answers, and you're dealing with people, sometimes very difficult people, emotional people," he sighed. "I just didn't enjoy it." When filming began at Elstree on April 7th, not only were the script and the sets still under construction, but also, apart from his decision to kill Ben Kenobi, Lucas had only recently settled on the last name, Skywalker, for his hero. It was a decision he fussed over. The Starkiller surname had been in his script for more than 3 years. But with the 1969 Charles Manson murders not yet a distant memory, Lucas worried that the name made Luke sound too much like a serial killer. The name of the film, too, was up in the air. While the crew would use clapperboards and notebooks emblazoned with a logo reading The Star Wars, Lucas had all but settled on dropping the definite article, preferring simply Star Wars. Even as cameras rolled, Barry and his crew were still putting the finishing touches on nearly 100 sets spread across the 8 sound stages. One of the most impressive was over on stage 3, where the full-sized Millennium Falcon sat, based on a detailed model sent over from ILM. Barry's construction crew quickly discovered, however, that scaled up, the entire ship wouldn't fit onto the soundstage. So only half was built against one wall. The rest would be added as a matte painting later, as needed. The ship was so enormous, in fact, that Lucas decided it was better just to leave it in place and build the needed sets around it, including the Docking Bay 94 hangar, where Han Solo would confront Jabba the Hutt, a sequence Lucas would tinker with, shelve, then revive nearly 20 years later with the help of new filmmaking technology. Everywhere he looked, all Lucas could see were the problems. Robots continued to malfunction and run into walls. Even after adjustment, Anthony Daniels' C-3PO costume still fit him poorly, leaving most of his upper body's weight resting so heavily on his hands that his thumbs went completely numb for the entire shoot. There was so little money that nearly all of the scenes on the Death Star were filmed on the same set, dressed several different ways, and John Barry squabbled with Lucas's director of photography over the best way to light them. For perhaps the first time, however, Lucas enjoyed working with his actors, even if his actors couldn't always tell. Typically, Lucas gave little or no feedback after takes, leaving the actors grasping for guidance. If he liked a take, he would simply mutter, "Cut, print it, perfect." If he didn't, he would offer one of only 2 bits of direction: faster, more intense, or same thing, only better. It got to be something of a joke with the actors, who would look expectantly at Lucas after every take, waiting for his response with mock excitement. George has such a clear vision in his head of what it is that he wants. Actually trying to get that out of an actor is a bit of an inconvenience, said Harrison Ford. That's not George's favorite part of a job, as Mark Hamill put it. I have a sneaking suspicion that if there were a way to make movies without actors, George would do it. And yet Lucas did like his actors. He was particularly fond of Hamill, who was exactly his kind of nerd. Short, with a geek's gung-ho fondness for comic books and toys. In fact, it didn't take Hamill long to realize that Lucas had infused more than a little of himself in the character of Luke. "I'm really playing him in the movie," said Hamill, who had watched Lucas closely as he acted out the scene in which Luke finds the runaway R2. "I was thinking, he's doing it so small, so I'll do it just like him," said Hamill, "and he'll see how wrong he is." But Lucas loved it, and Hamill would come to integrate a few of Lucas's quirks, smaller gestures, quieter dialogue, into his character. Lucas would take to warmly calling Hamill the Kid, a slight variation on the Stinky Kid nickname Coppola had bestowed on Lucas. Fisher, by contrast, reminded him of his own younger sister, tough and silly at the same time. Fisher had a wicked sense of humor and a foul mouth, fueled at times by a drug habit she managed to keep mostly hidden. And she had no trouble at all playing a tough-talking princess. And yet Lucas didn't want her looking too aggressively feminine, using gaffer's tape to hold down her breasts. "No breasts bounce in space, no jiggling in the Empire," Fisher snickered, adding, "Gary Kurtz had to tell me that. George didn't have the nerve." Still, despite her swagger, Fisher was insecure about playing Leia. She never felt she was pretty enough, disliked her earmuff hairstyle, couldn't decide what accent she should be using, and fretted about dropping her prop gun during her swing over a chasm with Hamill, but also worried that if she expressed any displeasure or discomfort, she would be fired and replaced by Jodie Foster, or any of the countless other actresses Lucas had rejected for the role. Ford, however, had no such inhibitions. Displaying a "the hell with it" attitude, and looking like he was having more fun than anyone else, Ford gave Han Solo just the right balance of smarm and charm. More than the other actors, Ford wasn't shy about voicing his displeasure with Lucas's jargon-heavy script and clunky dialogue. "You can type this shit, but you can't say it," he would tell Lucas brazenly, and Ford would go through his lines each day, slightly tweaking his dialogue, and warning Lucas when he intended to ad-lib in a particular take. "Stop me if I'm really bad," he would tell Lucas. But he was rarely stopped. None of them were, really. Lucas even kept in Hamill's ad-lib in which he winkingly gave Chewbacca's cell block number as 1138, a coy nod to Lucas's other science fiction film. "In terms of changing their lines," said Lucas, "well, that's a matter of letting them have their way." The chemistry, the magic, as Lucas had called it, among his cast, continued off-screen as well, and Lucas was relieved that, for the most part, his actors were hassle-free. "I only want people who are good, talented, and easy to work with," Lucas once remarked, "because life is too short for crazy actors." According to Hamill, the cast regularly went out of their way to try to make Lucas laugh, because he really looked like he was ready to burst into tears, and you'd try to cheer him up. Ultimately, they all came to trust in Lucas and his instincts as a director, even if they didn't always understand what was going on. "At times during Star Wars, I was perhaps a bit puzzled," said Guinness, "but I never lost faith in the project. There were people around who doubted the sanity of the venture and who were critical of George and Gary Kurtz. 'Lucas doesn't know what he's doing,' they'd say, or 'call this filmmaking?' But I had confidence in them." Still, even Guinness had his moments of rolling his eyes at what he called Lucas's ropey dialogue, as did Anthony Daniels and Mark Hamill, who bonded over their mutual snickering at their lines. When Hamill teased Daniels that 3PO's dialogue was worse than Luke's, Daniels pointed out that he, at least, was behind a mask. "None of my friends know I am in this movie, so it's fine." 3'8" Kenny Baker, anonymously ensconced inside R2-D2's aluminum shell when the script called for the little droid to shuffle or rock, also wondered what the movie was about. None of us knew. And yet he, too, would do his best to please Lucas, smiling broadly inside his R2 unit to convey R2's emotions, even though no one could see him. "You have to do something to get the feel of the thing," explained Baker with a shrug. Even Lucas's villains were relatively easygoing. Dave Prowse would walk forcefully around the sets between takes in his full Vader costume, doing his best to stay in character, but took it all in good stride when he learned that his castmates had dubbed him Darth Farmer, in playful reference to the West Country English accent in which he delivered his fearsome lines, to be dubbed later by James Earl Jones. Meanwhile, Peter Cushing, playing the cold Grand Moff Tarkin, was such a warm-hearted gentleman that Carrie Fisher found it difficult to rail angrily at him about his foul stench. "The man smelled like linen and lavender," she said. On April 13th, over on Elstree's Stage 6, Lucas would finally film the cantina sequence he'd been envisioning since the treatment for The Journal of the Whills, including the moment when someone loses an arm to a lightsaber. Unfortunately, it didn't live up to his expectations, and probably never would. Prior to filming, makeup artist and mask maker Stuart Freeborn became seriously ill and had to be hospitalized, leaving most of the cantina monsters unfinished. "The ones we did have were background monsters, which weren't meant to be key monsters," said Lucas. While he would shoot additional footage with some new monsters almost a year later, he would always be disappointed with the relatively unexpressive cantina creatures, most of whom could barely move their hands. Even the normally enthusiastic Hamill was unimpressed. "It was really imaginatively described, and then you go in there and it looks like the Nutcracker Suite," said Hamill. "You know, a frog guy, a mouse girl, it was really disappointing." But what disappointed Lucas more than anything else was the feeling that he was losing control of his own movie, Partly it was due to the size of the crew needed for a $10 million film. This wasn't American Graffiti, a $700,000 film shot over 28 days on the streets of Petaluma with a crew of fewer than 20. Star Wars required a crew of over 900. The larger the picture, the less time you have to deal with detail, said Kurtz. On a small picture, you can do everything yourself. That was the way Lucas would have preferred it. With such a large crew, he had no chance of controlling everything. Instead, he had to follow a chain of command, a process he found excruciating. Once a decision was made, I would tell a department head, and he would tell another assistant department head. He'd tell some guy, and by the time it came down the line, it was not there, complained Lucas. I spent all my time yelling and screaming at people, and I have never had to do that before. Ultimately, I tried to be in complete control, to do everything myself, but it almost killed me, he said. It was too difficult, and I was miserable because I agonized over things not turning out my way. That was particularly true of the film's editing. Always Lucas's favorite part of the process and the hardest task for him to turn over to another. As he had done with American Graffiti, Lucas was shipping off footage to be edited nearly as quickly as he was shooting it, this time sending each day's work to British editor John Jimpson. Although Jimpson was a veteran of more than 20 films, Lucas had hired him only grudgingly. Lucas's first choice, Richard Chu, who had edited for Coppola and Milos Forman, was scuttled by Fox executives who strongly recommended Lucas hire an editor based locally in London. Still, Jimpson seemed like a good choice. One of the many films he had edited was A Hard Day's Night, and Lucas hoped he would bring that same quick-cut cinema verite style to Star Wars. It didn't happen. I wasn't happy with it, said Lucas. I tried to get the editor to cut it my way, and he didn't really want to. In Lucas's opinion, Jimpson was making each scene too long and using too many wide shots. Lucas insisted that he wanted Star Wars to look like a documentary, an odd description to apply to a science fiction film, but an apt one, as Star Wars would look not like any other science fiction film. His used universe sensibility already gave the film a realism and an intimacy missing in most science fiction films. But Lucas wanted what John Barry described as a newsreel sort of feeling. As was his habit, Lucas had set up multiple cameras for each take, strolling the sets at night to go figure out the best camera angles, and then filmed every scene with three or four cameras rolling. And rather than beginning a new scene with a wide shot to let viewers see one of Barry's gigantic detailed sets, Lucas kept the camera in tight, letting the actors wander into the frame. Like it was shot on location, explained Barry. The film has to make us believe it really existed, explained Lucas, that we've really gone to another galaxy to shoot. The success of the imaginary, it's to make something totally fabricated seem real, that everything be credible and totally fantastic at the same time. But Jimpson hadn't captured any of that feeling in his edit, forcing Lucas to send lackluster footage back to Los Angeles for Alan Ladd and Fox executives to review. Worse, ILM still had no completed special effects shots, even as the effects budget kept pushing higher and higher. My head was in the shit, groaned Dykstra, who did his best to plead his case. We were designing and building optical printers, cameras, and miniatures. As a result, the process didn't produce a lot of film at first, Dykstra explained later. I can understand Lucas being nervous about it. He was helming the show, and the studio was nervous. It was no wonder, then, that Ladd decided to fly to London in early May to see exactly what was going on. I had been getting very negative feedback from London about the picture, Ladd remembered, and the picture was escalating in cost, so I thought I'd go see for myself. Ladd watched a few days of filming, walked the sets, then huddled with Kurtz and Lucas, hoping for reassurance. Lucas admitted Jimpson's footage looked terrible. I just wish you had never seen this stuff, he told Ladd. This is not what I want, Lucas assured him, and this is not what it's going to look like. Ladd went back to the studio and promised the board that things were fine. But my real reaction, said Ladd, was utter and complete panic. He wasn't alone. As filming continued through May, Lucas, who had managed to stay relatively stable for 8 weeks, finally buckled and fell ill, developing a hacking cough and a foot infection so painful he didn't even want to get out of bed. Partly, it was the pace. "We worked like stink 20 hours every day," said production supervisor Robert Watts. As Carrie Fisher remembered, "It was like combat shooting, because we had no time, because there was no budget." Mostly, though, the problem was that no matter how hard Lucas tried, nothing seemed to go right. "I cared about every single detail," said Lucas. "It's very hard for me to get into another system where everybody does things for me and I say, fine. If I ever continue to do these kinds of movies, I've got to learn to do that." Not surprisingly, when it came time to film the scene in the trash compactor, another sequence Lucas had included in his script since practically day one, his vision had been compromised by the chain of command. The fearsome tentacled monster he had envisioned in his script had been stripped down to resemble nothing so much as a big, wide, brown turd. Still, even Lucas's hectic pace couldn't overcome the endless delays caused by faulty props, malfunctioning robots, and the union-mandated quitting time. By June, Lucas had fallen more than a week behind schedule, and Dykstra and ILM weren't making things any easier, sending over front projection special effects shots that were out of focus, improperly lit, and completely unusable. "ILM was a mess," said Marcia Lucas. "They spent $1 million, and the effect shots they'd been able to composite were just completely unacceptable, like cardboard cutouts, the matte lines were showing." And then there was editor John Jimson, who was still cutting each day's footage together into what Lucas thought was a completely unwatchable film. "I don't think he fully understood the movie and what I was trying to do," Lucas said. Finally deciding enough was enough, Lucas dismissed the problematic editor in mid-June, groaning that the firing was a very frustrating and unhappy experience. The hour's worth of footage Jimson had already assembled would have to be completely recut. Dykstra and ILM were a different kind of problem. While Lucas had no intention of dismissing Dykstra, it was clearly time to have a heart-to-heart with him and his ILM team. Dykstra arrived in London on June 23rd to meet with Kurtz and Lucas at Elstree, with Kurtz doing most of the talking, since Lucas, now sicker than ever, had lost his voice. "We sat down with John and went over the optical effects," recalled Kurtz. Because the front projection effects had been unusable, it was decided that Lucas would shoot against a blue screen instead, with the effects shots to be added later. But scrapping even the few front projection shots they had meant starting over, and the clock was ticking, with roughly a year left to finish the effects. "We have 360 shots, that makes one shot a day," Kurtz told Dykstra. "Are we going to finish on time or not?" Dykstra took only a moment to consider, then hedged his answer. "If things go right," he told Kurtz. "Yeah, we can do that." Back in Hollywood, Ladd was under similar pressure from his fellow board members at Fox, who were steadily losing faith in Lucas and his late, expensive film. Concerns ran the gamut from the serious to the silly. There was hand-wringing over whether Chewbacca should wear pants. But Ladd was continuing to put his own reputation on the line, defending the movie and doing his best to keep executives away from Elstree and off Lucas's back. "There were a lot of problems, yes," said Ladd wearily. "Every board meeting I attended, the subject was always about Star Wars. It was rather unpleasant. Still, Ladd did such a good job keeping Fox executives in the dark that when Los Angeles Times film critic Charles Champlin traveled to London to write a story on Lucas, he was collared on his return by Fox board members who asked for a full report on what Lucas was up to. By mid-July, however, with Lucas still 15 days behind schedule, Ladd could no longer keep his board at bay with noncommittal reassurances. The plans for releasing Star Wars in time for Christmas 1976 had already been scrapped, and the board was losing patience. "You've got to finish in the next week," Ladd told Lucas, "because I've got another board meeting, and I can't go in there and say we're still shooting." Scrambling to finish then, Lucas split production between several units, bicycling frantically between sound stages to supervise as much of it as he could. Spielberg, itching to get his hands on Star Wars, even offered to oversee one of the second units. "George wouldn't let me," said Spielberg, a refusal he attributed to their increasing personal and professional rivalry. "I was admiring and jealous of his style, his proximity to audiences, but he did not want my fingerprints anywhere around Star Wars." On Friday, July 16th, 1976, Lucas completed principal photography. Though he ended up 20 days behind schedule, he was very nearly on budget thanks to a devaluing of the British pound, which reduced his overages to about $600,000. Fox still grumbled, but Lucas was generally pleased that he'd survived Tunisia and Elstree pretty much on target. "For what it was, Star Wars was made very inexpensively," Lucas said later, "a real low-budget movie." Still, that didn't mean he was happy with it. On Saturday morning, Lucas returned to the United States, stopping briefly in New York to see De Palma and then in Alabama to visit Spielberg, who was finishing work on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Spielberg pored over a booklet of black-and-white Star Wars stills Lucas had brought with him and was just amazed, said Spielberg. But George was so depressed. He didn't like the lighting. He didn't like what his cameraman had done for him. He was really upset. After leaving Spielberg, Lucas headed for Los Angeles to check on Dykstra and ILM. His mood would not improve. Despite the heart-to-heart with Dykstra in June, ILM was still woefully behind schedule. "They'd spent a year and $1 million and had one shot," recalled Lucas. While that shot, the escape pod ejecting from Leia's ship and spiraling down toward Tatooine, was a good one, Dykstra and his crew were showing no signs of picking up the pace. "Those guys didn't quite understand the critical nature of making a movie," Lucas said later. "You can't be a day late. It just doesn't work. It all fits together into a giant mosaic. All the pieces have to fall together." As Lucas saw it, the pieces were in danger of being lost altogether. "I thought, this is it. I really got myself into a mess I'll never get myself out of." He left Los Angeles for Northern California in a state of near despondency, and shortly after landing in San Francisco, Lucas suddenly felt sharp pains in his chest. Fearing a heart attack, Marcia checked George into the hospital, where he was diagnosed with hypertension and exhaustion, and was ordered to cut down the stress in his life. "That's when I really confirmed to myself I was going to change, that I wasn't going to make any more films," Lucas said. "I wasn't going to direct anymore. I was going to get my life a little more under control." But not yet. Lucas had no intention of relinquishing control over this film, even if it killed him. "If I left anything for a day," he feared, "it would fall apart, and it's purely because I set it up that way, and there is nothing I can do about it," Lucas said. "It wasn't set up so I could walk away from it. Whenever there is a leak in the dam, I have to stick my finger in it." It was time then to stick his finger in the dam. The first order of business was to get ILM to shape up, which meant a change in leadership at the workshop. Dykstra, with his laid-back collegial style, ran the place like a frat house, a quasi-hippie mentality, Kurtz called it. The staff was fiercely loyal to Dykstra, but to Lucas, that was part of the problem. He wanted them loyal to him, not Dykstra. After all, it was his film, his vision, and his money they were burning through. The best way for Lucas to control production, then, was literally to control production. Lucas announced he would personally oversee work at ILM on Mondays and Tuesdays, and brought in George Mather, an experienced production supervisor, to watch over things for the remainder of the week. For the ILMers, it was like bringing the principal into an unruly classroom. "There was a certain amount of resentment at first," said Kurtz. "Dykstra considered it an unnecessary hindrance to my work, but tried to be pragmatic. George brought in people meant to crack the whip," Dykstra said later. "Whether they felt like they succeeded or not, I don't know. They wanted to go from 0 to 60 in 1.2 seconds, and that wasn't in the cards. Even with Lucas and Mather overseeing things, there were still cost overruns. Explosions came in at $65,000 instead of the budgeted $35,000. But gradually, ILM began to fall into a more productive rhythm. We finally got up to 16 people in the optical department, working on two shifts, 11 hours a day, 6 days a week, recalled one ILM artist. Still, there was a reason why ILM had come to be called derisively the country club. Staff still kept irregular hours, working mostly at night to make conditions bearable in a building without air conditioning. During the days, Dykstra would often be found beating the heat by soaking in a large tank filled with cold water, along with as many of ILM's employees as could possibly fit, or leaping onto a water slide made from an airplane escape chute salvaged from the airport across the street. Our reputation wasn't stellar, admitted Dykstra, because we were breaking a lot of rules. That wasn't all they were breaking. One afternoon, Lucas and Kurtz pulled into the ILM parking lot just in time to see Dykstra, fumbling with the controls of a forklift, send a refrigerator plunging to the pavement. Lucas got out of the car, stepped around the wreckage, and walked into the warehouse. He never said a word. ILM's first real task had been to assemble the shots needed for the assault on the Death Star, especially since Fox, citing potential costs of the effects, was pressuring Lucas to remove the sequence from the film altogether. Lucas had explicitly described the sequence through 50 pages of his script, but he was still concerned it wouldn't look the way he envisioned it. I'm trying to make everything look very natural, a casual, almost I've seen this before look, he explained. Like the X-Wing and TIE fighter battle, you say, I've seen that, it's World War II, but wait a minute, that isn't any kind of jet I've ever seen before. I want the whole film to have that quality. It's a very hard thing to come by because it should look very familiar, but at the same time not be familiar at all. For guidance, the ILM crew looked to Lucas's reel of dogfight footage to get a better feel for how Lucas expected the ships to move, beyond what was described on the page. It was hugely helpful, said ILM artist Ken Ralston. To describe that abstract world of a battle is impossible. That footage was a great thing. The footage would also be of enormous use to the editor Lucas had recently installed at Parkhouse to replace Jimson, Marsha Lucas. George hadn't wanted Marsha editing Star Wars, and, truth be told, Marsha didn't really want to edit it either. Not only was she still trying to be seen as more than just an editor of her husband's films, but also, as far as she was concerned, Star Wars was beneath George's talents. She wanted him working on more serious, artistic films, the kind Coppola made, for example, and the kind she had edited for Martin Scorsese and Michael Ritchie. For his part, Lucas had wanted Marsha to take some downtime after completing Taxi Driver, with the hope they could conceive a child. But the pregnancy never happened, and Lucas, agonizing over a replacement for Jimson, and needing an editor who knew and understood his rhythms as a director, had finally asked for her help. As Marsha waited for ILM to complete its shots, she would splice in footage of swooping Tomahawk airplanes and tail-spinning Messerschmitts between shots of X-Wing pilots chattering at one another in their cockpits, and Leia monitoring the fight from the base on Yavin. And the moment the effects came in from ILM, she would replace the black-and-white shots with the new footage. More often than not, she had to use every last inch of film ILM had shot, some of which took up no more than a few seconds of screen time. Lucas may have intended to hover over Marsha as he had during American Graffiti, but there just wasn't enough time. He had to relinquish the tough work and control to her. And ultimately, Lucas had to admit he was impressed. I think it took her 8 weeks to cut that battle, he said later. It was extremely complex, and we had 40,000 feet of dialogue footage of pilots saying this and that, and she had to cull through all that and put in all the fighting as well. Lucas would later compare the editing of Star Wars to sleight of hand, pointing out that there actually weren't very many ships in a given shot, and noting a lack of continuity between some cuts. But the effects footage was edited together so carefully and seamlessly with the live-action shots that the technicalities hardly mattered, The quick cutting of the effect shots is part of what makes the sequences so exciting. Unlike in 2001, Lucas's ships wouldn't slowly roll and rumble to a Strauss waltz. They tumbled and whizzed to John Williams' blaring trumpets. Lucas's direction to his actors, faster and more intense, would apply to the editing as well. There would be no lingering or loitering. Necessity had forced Marcia to cut shots in quickly, letting the entire Death Star sequence throb at a breathtaking pace all its own. Even more remarkably, under Marcia's careful editorial eye, it is always easy to tell what is going on. In several places, she made editorial decisions to clarify the story and speed things up even more, such as reducing the number of X-Wing pilots seen on screen to keep the focus on Luke, and paring down the trench run so that Luke made only one attempt to take the fatal shot instead of the two Lucas had specified in his script. With Marcia immersed in the Death Star sequence, Lucas brought in Richard Chu, his first choice for editor before Fox had imposed Jimson on him, to take apart Jimson's problematic rough cut and start over again. And then, once he'd reassembled the first hour of the film, Chu was to move on to the dogfight that followed the escape from the Death Star. Chu sat down at the editing table at Park House in August. Lucas wanted a rough cut ready to look at by Thanksgiving. But with nearly 340,000 feet of live-action film footage to sort through, it was a task that required yet another set of skilled eyes and hands. At the suggestion of Brian De Palma, Lucas hired a third editor, Paul Hirsch, who had edited both Phantom of the Paradise and Carrie for De Palma. But even his experience cutting those quirky films hadn't prepared him for the gigantic task that was Star Wars. "I've never worked on anything this complicated before," Hirsch told Lucas. "That's all right," Lucas said matter-of-factly. "Nobody has." Lucas spent most of the autumn of 1976 sprinting back and forth between Park House in San Anselmo and ILM in Los Angeles, trying desperately to keep his finger in the dam. He and Dykstra were butting heads more and more now, even as Mather and Kurtz tried to run interference between the two. Lucas was growing tired of Dykstra's having to explain why certain shots weren't working, while Dykstra, for his part, simply felt he was trying to manage Lucas's expectations. "Directors and special effects directors disagree incredibly," said Dykstra, "because the director conceptualizes one thing, but I know what is capable of being produced. It's hard to explain that a concept won't work because of some technological thing, and this becomes a bone of contention." But Lucas wasn't interested in excuses. "I was interested in the shots," he said flatly. "I didn't care how he got the shots. I just wanted the composition and the lighting to be good, and I wanted them to get it done on time." Even the mild-mannered Kurtz began to share Lucas's annoyance. "John Dykstra has a tendency to talk everything to death," said Kurtz. "Both George and I were rather frustrated about that. John assembled a lot of talent, but it was never run properly. It was like organized anarchy. But it was also working." On October 11, 1976, Lucas approved the first ILM special effects shot, initialing it with a small cursive GL. They'd spent a year and $1 million and had one shot, a cannon going boom, 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 recalled Lucas. "I said, okay, at least we're on our way." As Lucas had hoped, a rough cut of the film was ready by early November. It was admittedly ragged. Most of the special effect shots were missing, sound effects were incomplete, none of the voices had been dubbed, Vader still spoke in Prowse's working-class English accent, and there was no music. But Lucas was ready to start showing it around, anxious to get feedback on the film, especially now that it was finally starting to resemble the version he had seen in his head for so long. "For me, it was a very rewarding thing to show it to people, even though it was in bad shape," said Lucas. Lucas's first audience was the editing team. He and his three editors watched the movie in the screening room at Park House, and then watched it again and again, talking each scene through and looking for places where things could be cut or improved. Over Marsha's objections, Lucas knocked out an early scene on Tatooine in which Luke discussed the rebellion with several other young friends. Lucas thought it seemed too much like a scene from American Graffiti, and structurally, he didn't like the idea of introducing Luke so early in the story, so out it went. The other problematic scene, however, a conversation between Harrison Ford as Han Solo and actor Declan Mulholland playing Jabba the Hutt, was going to require a little more work to correct. Lucas had hoped to mat in a stop-motion Jabba over Mulholland, but that was going to take time he didn't have and more money than Fox was willing to provide. The scene could be cut, but Lucas would need some new dialogue to explain Solo's predicament. The solution, then, was to shoot additional cantina footage with Greedo, and, he hoped, insert a few shots featuring new monsters, since he had never been happy with the footage he had shot at Elstree with Freeborn's background creatures. But reshooting was still going to require going back to Fox for more money, and with the film approaching budget overages of nearly $2 million now, all Ladd could pry out of the studio was a miserly $20,000. It would have to do. With Freeborn still unavailable, Lucas hired 25-year-old makeup artist Rick Baker and gave him 6 weeks to build as many creatures as he could. In January, Lucas would spend 2 days shooting new footage in a studio on La Brea in Hollywood, where Baker had indeed given him an impressive new array of monsters, including the cantina's memorable swing band. But Lucas was still disappointed with the final result. "I really wanted to have horrible, crazy, really staggering monsters," he told Rolling Stone later. "I guess we got some, but we didn't come off as well as I had hoped." Audiences loved it, but Lucas would remain unhappy with the scene for nearly 20 years, until evolving digital technology would finally permit him to insert what he considered much more acceptable monsters. Near Christmas, Marsha left for Los Angeles to work on New York, New York, after an impassioned phone call from Martin Scorsese, whose editor had died before the movie could be completed. It was a move that irritated Lucas, who still disapproved of Scorsese and his drugs and multiple girlfriends. "For George, the whole thing was that Marsha was going off to this den of iniquity," said Willard Hike. "George was a family homebody. He couldn't believe the stories that Marsha told him." George would fume because Marsha was running with these people. She loved being with Marty. Indeed, Marsha could never say no to Scorsese, who made the kinds of films she wished her own husband would make. Paul Hirsch, listening from his editing table to the debate between the Lucases, thought he understood. Marsha respected Marty above all directors and didn't believe in Star Wars very much, said Hirsch. It was not her thing. Marsha left for Los Angeles and Scorsese's serious artistic film, handing her editing duties over to Hirsch. Lucas waved goodbye, his mouth a tight white line. At the same time he was looking over Hirsch's shoulder, Lucas was also working with Ben Burtt to improve the way the film sounded, always one of Lucas's major concerns. Until Williams could deliver the music, Lucas had cut in a temporary score of classical music, including bits of Holst's The Planets and Dvorak's New World Symphony. Meanwhile, Burtt had set up an office in Park House and had been working over the past year to find a sound for, well, just about everything, since Lucas insisted that every sound heard in the movie had to be created. "When a door slammed, we didn't use the sound of a door slamming on Earth," said Lucas. While Burtt had found just the right sounds for laser blasts and food processors and whirring robot motors, he and Lucas still had to deal with three key voices, R2-D2, C-3PO, and Darth Vader. For Burtt, R2 was probably the toughest. "We had to decide his mentality and his personality," said Burtt. "We decided he was intelligent but emotionally a 5-year-old kid. Frightened, but brave." The trick, then, to getting the organic sound Lucas wanted was for him and Burtt to record themselves cooing, beeping, and whistling into a tape recorder, which Burtt then ran through a synthesizer, tweaking pitch and speed, until he found just the right voice for any situation. I knew I had succeeded, recalled Bert, because the film editors began to cut to R2 for a reaction. When it came to 3PO, the voice Lucas had in mind was that of a slick used car salesman, with a whiff of the Bronx about him. During filming, however, Anthony Daniels had delivered his lines in the manner of a fussy English butler, which he thought better fit the character. Lucas worried that Daniels's voice was strongly British. I didn't want that, even though everybody else liked it. But after auditioning several voice actors, including Stan Freeberg, Lucas had to concede that Daniels's voice had the most character. It would stay. Not so the voice of Darth Vader. While Vader's signature breathing had been provided by Bert recording himself huffing into a scuba mouthpiece, Bert had no idea how the character's speaking voice would actually sound. Lucas wanted a commanding voice for Vader, and originally considered Orson Welles before deciding he might be too recognizable. Instead, he approached actor James Earl Jones, a 1970 Oscar nominee for The Great White Hope, whose voice was a natural and intimidating bass. He picked a voice that was born in Mississippi, raised in Michigan, and was a stutterer, said Jones. It was also pitch perfect, though Jones asked that his name be kept out of the credits, insisting that he was just special effects. In early January 1977, Lucas hosted another showing of the rough cut, this time for composer John Williams. Over the course of 2 days, Williams would watch the film several times, taking careful notes and looking for places in the film where he could lay in musical cues. I came back to my little room and started working on themes, said Williams. I spent the months of January and February writing the score. Later that month, Lucas brought in Ladd and several other executives from Fox so they could finally see for themselves the project on which Ladd had been staking his reputation. Gareth Wiggin, one of the few Fox executives who had steadfastly backed Ladd and Lucas over the past year, was so moved by the film that he wept with joy in his seat next to Lucas, who could only squirm uncomfortably. I couldn't believe it, said Lucas. I thought, this is really weird. But even in the film's primitive state, Wiggin knew he had seen something remarkable. Returning home that night, he told his wife, "The most extraordinary day of my life has just taken place." Still, Wiggin's emotional response couldn't prepare Lucas for perhaps his toughest audience of all. In late February, George and Marcia invited to Park House a small group of friends, including Spielberg, De Palma, The Hikes, John Milius, Hal Barwood, and Matthew Robbins, for a look at the most recent cut. I show them all of my footage, and they give me precious opinions that I count on, Lucas explained later. When you don't know people well, they either give you dishonest compliments or tell you how they would shoot it, and that's not what you're asking them for. With this group, however, honesty wouldn't be a problem. The reaction, said Spielberg frankly, was not a good one. When the lights went up, Marcia, who hadn't seen the film since the first cut, burst into tears, certain it was a disaster. Hike muttered that he found the opening crawl jiggly and it went on forever. Barwood tried to be supportive, reassuring Lucas that there was still enough time to fix everything if they could shoot some extra footage. De Palma, however, was blistering in his criticism, carping about everything from Leia's hair to Vader's non-dramatic entrance in the opening scene. "What's all the force shit?" De Palma thundered. "Where's the blood when they shoot people?" De Palma would continue to rail at Lucas over dinner at a Chinese restaurant, like a crazed dog, recalled Gloria Katz. "Brian kind of went over the top in terms of his honesty," agreed Spielberg. Still, Lucas refused to back down. "You should talk," Lucas told De Palma snarkily. "None of your films have made a dime." To the surprise of most onlookers, De Palma agreed to help Lucas rewrite and reshoot the opening crawl. Still, there was one person in the room who was impressed. "I loved it because I love the story and the characters," said Spielberg. "I was probably the only one who liked it, and I told George how much I loved it." That evening, Ladd called Spielberg on the sly to ask what he thought about what he'd seen. Spielberg told the executive he thought he had a hit on his hands, one that would eventually make about $50 million or $60 million. "Wow, were we wrong," laughed Spielberg. On March 5, 1977, Lucas settled into a seat in the control booth at Anvil Studios in the little English village of Denham. He was exhausted. Only 4 days earlier, he'd been at Goldwyn Studios in Los Angeles to spend the day recording James Earl Jones's dialogue for Darth Vader, and now he was at Anvil to oversee a week of recording sessions for John Williams's score. On the other side of the soundproof glass, Williams was, for the first time in his career, conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. As the opening moments of the film were projected overhead onto a 34-foot screen, and the orchestra erupted into Williams's heroic fanfare, Lucas was visibly moved. "To hear Johnny play the music for the first time was a thrill beyond anything I can describe," said Lucas, who knew he had something special in Williams's score and the immediately recognizable themes he had provided for key characters. "A lot of the emotional content is carried through the music as much as through the scenes themselves," Lucas said. It was no surprise that Lucas would insist on serving as producer for Williams's recording sessions. As post-production kicked into overdrive during the spring, Lucas was still overseeing as many of the details himself as he possibly could, even acting out each of the holographic monsters that would fight one another on the Falcon's chessboard. Still, he was visiting ILM less and less now, leaving Kurtz to send detailed reports back to Fox, even as effect shots continued into April. And Lucas admitted that he was happy with a lot of the special effects toward the end. The operation got very good. Still, he remained annoyed with the accountants at Fox, who had nickel and dimed him every step of the way. "The fact is that we didn't have the money, and the key to special effects is time and money," he said angrily. "I had to cut corners like crazy. The film is about 25% of what I wanted it to be." Those cut corners would grate on Lucas for years, part of the reason he would continue tinkering with the film for the next 4 decades, trying to get the effects to look the way he had always imagined them. At the end of March, another group of Fox executives, this time the sales team tasked with booking the film in theaters, filed into the screening room at Park House to watch the latest cut of Star Wars. Ladd sat by the phone in his Hollywood office, waiting for bad news. The call never came. Instead, the sales reps were ecstatic. "Extraordinary," one said succinctly, while another shouted to Ladd over the phone, "I don't believe what I've seen." And yet the enthusiasm of the sales team still couldn't overcome the skepticism of dubious Fox higher-ups, who remained uncertain that Star Wars could compete in an aggressive summer movie market. They were particularly worried about William Friedkin's thriller, Sorcerer. Hoping to cut its losses then, Fox had opted to move the release date back from summer to spring, to May 25th, the Wednesday before Memorial Day, when it might have a chance to recover some of its costs before being washed away in the deluge of summer films. Lucas later claimed that it was actually he who had talked the studio into a May release, arguing that kids would see the movie, then spread the word back at school. Regardless, fewer than 40 theaters agreed to show it. Lucas spent the months and weeks prior to the film's release trying to manage expectations. "Making a movie is a terribly painful experience," he told the New York Times, and he swore that with Star Wars, he had gotten big-budget films out of his system, never to return, whether the movie succeeded or not. "I'm much more of a filmmaker than a film director," he insisted, drawing what he thought was an important distinction between artist and auteur. "So I really want to retire and do a lot of experimental work with film that will probably never be seen by anybody." To the French periodical Écran, he reiterated that he had taken on Star Wars simply because, "I wanted to know if I could do it, but now that it's done, there's no need to do it again. I want to go back to more experimental films." It was an empty vow, but one that he would make repeatedly throughout his career, swearing he wanted nothing more than to abandon mainstream filmmaking and return to the kinds of eclectic, arty films he had made as a student. And yet, even as Lucas downplayed it, the film was gaining a quiet underground momentum. Marcia had once remarked that George knew who his audience was, but so did the man Lucas and Kurtz had tapped as the Star Wars Corporation's vice president of advertising, publicity, promotion, and merchandising, Charles Lippincott. The savvy Lippincott understood that science fiction and comic book fans, even in their respective loosely organized mid-1970s states, were the natural audience for Star Wars. "Why not tailor a campaign and build off of that?" Lippincott asked. "Do a novelization and comic book adaptation early." So, 2 years earlier, in November 1975, Lippincott had approached Ballantine Books about publishing a novelization of Lucas's script, ghostwritten by Alan Dean Foster, an up-and-coming science fiction writer who had a knack for TV and film adaptations. Judy Lynn Del Rey, Ballantine's science fiction editor, had seen the potential in Star Wars immediately. "I said we'd make millions, but everybody kept saying, 'Yeah, sure, now go away.'" The novel had been released in November 1976, just ahead of the first makeshift movie trailer, and by February 1977 had sold out of its first print run of 125,000, with the movie still 3 months away. Lippincott had also worked hard to ink a deal with Marvel Comics for a 6-issue comic book adaptation. After being stiff-armed by an uninterested Stan Lee, Lippincott had used Ed Summer, co-owner of Lucas's Super Snipe comic book store, to wangle an introduction to comics writer Roy Thomas in early 1976. With Thomas and artist Howard Chaykin on board, Lippincott went back to the still skeptical Lee to finish the deal. Lee insisted that Marvel wouldn't pay Lucasfilm a cent until the comic had sold at least 100,000 copies, terms Lippincott agreed to on the condition that at least 2 issues of the series had to be published before the May 25th release date for the film. "I got the deal through and went back to 20th Century Fox, and they said I was stupid," recalled Lippincott. "They didn't care about the money issue. They just thought I was wasting my time on a comic book deal." Like the novel, the comics too would quickly blow through their initial print runs. Lippincott also relied on fandom to spread the word about the film, hosting one of the first ever movie-related sessions at the San Diego Comic-Con in July 1976. Where he, Thomas, and Chaykin answered questions and sold posters designed by Chaykin. Several weeks later, at Worldcon in Kansas City, Lippincott made an even bigger splash when he put up a display featuring full-sized reproductions of Darth Vader, 3PO, and R2, as well as stills, Macquarie's concept art, and prop blasters and lightsabers. With the aid of Gary Kurtz and the always game Mark Hamill, Lippincott hosted an hour-long slideshow presentation that had the entire convention buzzing with excitement. The next several months saw well-timed articles in several sci-fi and film trade magazines, American Film, Sight and Sound, Fantasine, as well as a trailer that revealed just enough of the film's spectacular effects, though Lucas was shocked when audiences laughed at the shot of a Jawa-stunned R2 falling over, and enigmatic lobby posters that simply blared, "Coming to your galaxy this summer," in gigantic letters. There were a few mainstream articles, though most got nearly everything wrong. Stormtroopers were referred to as robots. Vader was a black knight. Chewbacca was an ape man. It didn't seem to matter much among fandom, who could tell that this movie with the bashed-up spaceships and oily robots didn't look like anything else. By the spring of 1977, enthusiasm for Star Wars was like a pot rolling to a slow boil, and the lid was about to blow off. The premiere of Star Wars was held on Sunday, May 1st, at San Francisco's North Point Theater, the very same theater where American Graffiti had made its successful debut 4 years earlier. Lucas sat with Marcia on a break from editing New York, New York, and braced himself for the worst. He'd warned editor Paul Hirsch that they'd likely have to recut the entire movie. Marcia had given him a good gauge of the film's success. "If the audience doesn't cheer when Han Solo comes in at the last second in the Millennium Falcon to help Luke when he's being chased by Vader," she told him, "the picture doesn't work." As the lights went down, Lucas locked eyes momentarily with Alan Ladd, whose reputation was as wrapped up in the film as his own. The picture had to work. Did it ever? The moment the enormous Star Destroyer rumbled overhead in the film's opening shot, the audience roared with an excitement that thundered louder and louder as the movie continued. Macquarie remembered lots of hollering and cheering, and, sure enough, the place exploded with excitement when the Falcon came to the rescue in the final reel. At the end of the film, the applause tidal waved. It kept going on. It wasn't stopping, said Ladd, and I just never had experienced that kind of reaction to any movie ever. Finally, when it was over, I had to get up and walk outside because of the tears. Outside the theater, Lucas's father was proudly shaking hands with anyone and everyone. Thank you, he would say, beaming. Thank you very much for helping out George. Hirsch sidled up to Lucas as he left the screening, trying to gauge his reaction. Well, Lucas told the editor thoughtfully, I guess we won't have to change anything after all. Still, Lucas was trying not to get too confident. At another showing for Fox executives several days later at the Metro Theater, the response wasn't quite as enthusiastic. Gareth Wiggin, the executive who had openly wept at the private showing months earlier, remembered that three execs loved it, three liked it, two fell asleep, and the rest really didn't get it at all and were very distressed, indeed, very worried about how they were going to get their money back. Ladd could only sit with his head in his hands, insisting, you should have seen the North Point. Fox had handpicked the 37 theaters in the markets where Star Wars would be opening, most of which were equipped only with monaural sound systems, not stereo. It was an important distinction because that wasn't the way Lucas wanted Star Wars to sound. He wanted the audience to become completely immersed in the film, which meant he wanted the soundtrack crystal clear, in stereo, with no background hiss. And that meant he wanted the film in Dolby stereo. Film sound tended to become distorted once the movie got into the theater. A film in Dolby would actually sound the way it did as Lucas was mixing it. Unfortunately, there weren't a lot of theaters in 1977 equipped to show films with Dolby stereo soundtracks, and those that were often had problems with speakers blowing. Lucas insisted he wanted the film in stereo and he wanted it sounding great, at least in those theaters equipped for Dolby, and so he had overseen the stereo mix himself in April. Now in May, he was personally editing the mono mix as well, working all night at Goldwyn Studios in Hollywood, the same studio, in fact, where Marcia was working all day, finishing edits for New York, New York. Early on the afternoon of Wednesday, May 25th, Lucas emerged bleary-eyed from yet another all-night work session at Goldwyn. As he was leaving, Marcia was just arriving, and the two of them decided to have a late lunch together, heading for the Hamburger Hamlet on Hollywood Boulevard, just across from Grauman's Chinese Theater. From their table in the back, he and Marcia could see out the front window onto the street, which was becoming more and more crowded with people. It was like a mob scene, Lucas recalled. One lane of traffic was blocked off. There were police there. There were lines 8 or 9 people wide, going both ways around the block. He and Marcia finished their lunch, then stepped out into the street to see what all the fuss was about. I thought someone must be premiering a movie, Lucas said later. Someone was. Emblazoned in huge letters on the marquee on both sides of the entrance above the loud, teeming crowd were two words, Star Wars.